Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Cotton Grower Magazine's Cotton Companion Podcast. This is Jim Stedman, editor of Cotton Grower, and I'm flying solo again today while my good friend and colleague Beck Barnes is away on business. Now, if you've been around the cotton business long enough, or if you've at least talked to enough long-timers, you know there's always certain cotton varieties that hold a special place in their memory. And maybe these were high-yielding varieties, maybe they were game-changers on somebody's farm, or maybe they were just easy to grow. But regardless, you strike up a conversation sometime and you're still going to hear folks lament about some of their long-gone favorites. Now, as we know, change has always been hard in an industry like cotton, which has a long history of how things are done. And obviously, that change is continuing with the introduction of new technologies, new trait packages, and newer high-yielding varieties, especially over the past 25 years. But still, some folks wonder how some of those old favorite varieties might match up with today's high-powered options. Now, one of those wonderers out there is Jay Mahaffey, who is science fellow at Bayer Crop Sciences Scott Learning Center in Scott, Mississippi. It's where he evaluates new technologies and varieties in various cropping systems and in various conditions. And one of his more recent studies compared some of those longtime favorite varieties, to some of today's counterparts. He dubbed it Antique Alley, and he's going to join me here in just a few minutes to talk about his work. But first, our sponsoring partner, American Cotton Shippers Association, has a brief message they'd like to share.
The American Cotton Shippers Association, also known as ACSA, is a trade association primarily made up of cotton merchants founded in 1924. ACSA members manage the majority of the world's cotton trade, providing services of merchandising, delivery logistics, and risk management to their customers. ACSA is proud to be celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Join them in Scottsdale, Arizona in June 2024 for their centennial celebration event.
As always, thanks to our friends at ACSA for that message and for their support. So here we are 1 month into the 2024 cotton season, according to USDA. And although it's still early for most growers, the weekly crop progress report is showing some definite action in parts of the cotton belt. The most recent report for the week ending April 21st shows that 11% of this year's crop is now in the ground, which is right in step with the five-year average for late April. Now, obviously, the biggest percentages of plantings is still coming from Arizona, California, and south and coastal Texas, but there's also some very preliminary progress reported in 10 other states, which basically means planters are now rolling in varying degrees in 13 of the 15 primary cotton-producing states. And we're going to keep watching that weekly progress and keep you up to date on the report as we move into our primary May planting season. Well, now it's my pleasure to welcome Jay Mahaffey, who is a science fellow at Bayer Crop Sciences Scott Learning Center in Scott, Mississippi, into the Cotton Companion virtual studio. Jay, welcome. Glad to have you.
Well, good morning. I'm glad to be here. Talk to the cotton world.
Great. Well, first of all, I got to admit, you've got one of the more unusual job titles in the industry. Can you tell us a little bit about the Learning Center and what your responsibilities are there?
Well, the Learning Center is located at sort of the ancestral home of Delta Pine or Delta and Pine Land Company, where the company was founded over 100 years ago. We follow through that legacy of developing cotton varieties and supporting cotton varieties and have grown into a bigger organization or a more diverse group of science that we generate here at Scott. The short of it is I've got 400 acres that I farm here at Scott, Mississippi. We farm corn, cotton, soybeans on that land. We also work on all sorts of agronomic questions that people may ask through the year. And when you characterize it as unique, I'm proud of that, because what we are able to do here is take input from growers and customers, broader industry, you know, the concerned public for that matter, and answer or attempt to answer questions that they may ask us about how to best use our products. You know, the different crops have different priorities. When you think about corn, it's really a mathematics problem. We have to figure out what to do before we plant, because all the decisions we make are done before during planting. soybeans, they are compensatory in a way that we've shown here that help growers make replant decisions, those kinds of things. And then the primary focus of our efforts here is to work on cotton. We spend about half our time working on cotton because it's a crop that changes as each new generation of products are introduced. And when I say changes, we have to characterize the behavior of the variety. We have to learn how it responds to PGRs. We have to take into consideration the biotech traits that have been introduced into those products, things like Thrivone, Bolgard 3, the herbicidal traits. So cotton is a very dynamic matter that requires a management scheme to be established during the season. And we attempt to learn those things prior to the introduction of new varieties on a broad scale to growers. So we cut the learning curve off some, hopefully.
Cool. Well, you know, you mentioned generational changes in cotton. And I know you and I had the opportunity to visit a little bit last season when I was down at the center and we were talking about some things, and you brought up the Antique Alley project. Where did that idea come from? Did anyone encourage you to take on this project, or what were you hoping to find out?
I'm not sure exactly how it all originated other than it was a product of my career, basically. And it's not about Jay, but my time at Delta Pine and my time at Scott started in 1995 as we introduced Bolgard. Prior to that time, I scouted cotton in Northeast Louisiana for other consultants and various people and growers. So I've been around the cotton business through the phases and the changes that we've observed and experienced with technology and boll weevil eradication. And I take time to mention this because cotton is unique in that it has seen some radical change in the way we produce the crop. You know, you think about, I think about my experience in the early 90s, late 80s, scouting cotton. Boll weevils and tobacco budworms were our primary concern. Everything we did in cotton fields was meant to make the cotton earlier, typically earlier, even if we sacrificed yield at times, because we had to evade the insects in the late season due to resistance, insecticide resistance. Well, I moved to Delta Pine. Actually, I moved from Louisiana to North Carolina, and they had eradicated weevils when I got there. And I realized at that point, this was going to change cotton production. It was a different deal than I had grown up experiencing. After grad school, I moved to Scott, and I came here prior to the launch of Bolgard in 96. It was actually 95 was a seed production year, and then 96, first big commercial year. Well, there are pains and changes that occur with all of that that really overlay the entire matter of new varietal introduction. You've got new biotech traits, which are radical. They were a radical change in our insect control system. We had to learn to deal with Lagos bugs on a little more intense level. All of those things happened, and each of them brought new varieties along. You think about the experience with varieties. Back in the 90s, mid and late 90s, we were growing things like Delta Pine 50 and SureGrow 125, that kind of material that was very early. Bolgard was introduced into some mid and later season type genetics that were much more indeterminate and required a different sort of management. In every generation of these products, we've seen those kind of changes, either based around biotech traits, which help us manage these, you know, these huge outbreaks of insects that we typically don't experience much now because we don't disrupt the system as much, spraying weevils and all those things. The pests are still out there. And we have the tools there to help us manage that risk. But we introduce those and we bring along new genetics every time we change, every variety that's introduced. So the origin of this project was I realized that we had access. Well, I didn't realize we had the access initially, but I knew we had seen radical changes in my time. What I wanted to really do with this was see if we could identify how the cotton plant has changed or not changed. In response to the breeding efforts, the biotech tools that help us protect the fruit we do set, all of those kinds of things. So really how it started was I had a group that is in some of the breeding functions here at Scott that wanted to increase some non-traded seed. And they asked me to help them do that. And I said, yeah, sure, I'm always willing to cooperate. So they gave me a list of what it was, and it was a group of about 12 or 14 varieties, including things like 5415, SureGrow 125 and 501, Delta Opal was one of the varieties. And I was just going to plant them in the field and show those older products to growers, because that's just cool. I mean, I thought it was just neat. You know, every farmer, every cotton farmer remembers SureGrow 125.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it grew into something bigger than that, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So, I hope.
It is, definitely. Now, you mentioned some of the specific varieties. In total, when you got this thing going, how many varieties did you end up with in this?
I actually wound up with seven varieties that represented an average PVP or introduction date of 1995.
Okay.
And those contain no Bolgard, no Roundup, no herbicidal traits. You know, they're just conventional cotton.
Yeah. You mentioned SureGrow. Do you got any, can we go back even farther into like Paymaster and some of those varieties? Were those included?
No, I did not. And I had to take what I could get.
I'm sure.
It was
whatever you could find, right?
Yeah, it was a fortuitous matter to start with. So,
well, you said now you've got this study done. You've got your data collected. What were some of the key findings out of this? That things like yield or harvestable bolls, or you know, potential revenue differences, things like that really stood out in this
well,
study.
Yeah, I think, if you don't mind, it's worth mentioning what I actually did. Because
okay.
What I did was I compared seven of the older products to seven brand new, or not brand new, but reasonably new products that represented an introduction date of about 2020 or 2021.
Okay.
So, and I compared them with and without PGRs. Now, my intent originally was to see if I could document a difference in the response of the varieties to PGRs. Because the basis of the question was this. We've all, as an industry, been out for a long time running around saying cotton varieties are different. The observable recorded yields are higher today than they were 25 years ago. I don't think anybody would dispute that.
Right.
The question is why? Why did that happen? And that is really the foundational question of the Learning Center is why. You know, I don't necessarily accept much at face value. I want to know the details. So what we ultimately did was compared those varieties in that system, intending originally to look at PGR response. Now, there were a couple of qualifiers about the season I would like to mention. First of all, this is one experiment done in one location, one year, one environment. I understand that. It, however, represents a system that I think, just by way of background, we did not see tremendous response from PGR in any of the varieties, old or new. So it was just that sort of year. You know, we reduced the height of some of them 8 or 10 inches. That's atypical for the Scott environment. What it did allow, though, in that environment was us to evaluate these varieties and their yield potential in very, very high yielding environments, you know, getting on up close to 2,000 pounds of length.
Right.
And I just think it's worthwhile to mention that, because what we really did was I have created over the last 3 or 4 years this system we call the bolometer. It's basically a way to rather quickly positionally map cotton.
Okay.
Which has a basis in a pretty long basis in history of you basically pick every boll off by position and by node, and you can document yield accumulation up and down the cotton plant. Cotton's fairly unique in that it fruits, you know, 100 times or so over about 90 days during the season. So to know if you have any great effects on fruit at one time or one position on the plant, which are sort of similar, you really got to do this kind of work. And mm-hmm. It's historically been very painful. And that's an understatement. Some folks are nodding their head right now listening to this.
I'm sure they are.
Painful is an understatement. But anyway, we built a system that allows us to do it in about a quarter of the time it took historically. Anyway, we mapped all of these plots. We carried it all the way through HVI, established loan values for the various positions on the plant. And then we did the things that you're asking about. I spent all of the month of December just jolly chuckling around my house working on this, having the grandest time. And we were able to find some things that I think enlighten us about cotton varieties.
Okay.
So when you look at those, considering what this test is, what we actually found, we even carried this through all the distance of, you know, the concentration of oil in the seed, all of those kinds of things, because these are relevant factors when it comes to sort of philosophically considering how we manage cotton this year and other years moving forward. Because like I said, it's not news that cotton varieties changed. The question is, what changed and how do we respond to it?
Sure.
To optimize the genetics when they're introduced. So the primary things that we observed, I would say that one of those and one change that historically has occurred is cotton planting rates in recent times are lower than they have been in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, when I moved here, we were planting 50 and 55,000 seeds an acre. Now we plant greatly less than that, at times too much less than that. But regardless, the final stands in these tests were in the range of about, you know, the high 20s to the low 30,000s established. One result of that is we saw a much higher percentage of the crop generated on monopodial or vegetative branches. If you look at the historical data, you know, it shows sub 10% of the yield potential to be on those positions, the vegetative branches.
Mm-hmm.
In this work at those populations, we showed about 30% of the potential to come from those positions. So that's one major change. Another major thing that we identified through this was as we looked at the growth and the growth habit of the plants. I don't really know which order to go about this in. Maybe y'all might have to rearrange this through the. One thing we saw, I'm just going to go through it how it makes sense logically.
Okay.
In the end, at the end of the mapping process, we pull the bowls off by cohort. So we put all the vegetative bowls in one group, all the first, all the seconds, and all the third positions into a cohort. I gen those as that. And established a loan value for them. In that process, what we found was that it allowed us to calculate the weight of the bowls, and some of this stuff I won't talk too much about because it's a lot of detail, but it's in the final report. But what we were able to do is go back and calculate a likelihood of harvesting a bowl on a given position on the plant.
Okay.
Probability. Because that's what we're getting to. I mean, more bowls are typically more yield. And what we learned from that was, number one, yes, we did harvest significantly more bowls in those newer varieties where they were aggressively managed. And there were other differences too, but I'm talking about the most, sort of the most inflammatory difference, I guess, here. If you compare the old varieties with no growth regulator, which is really how we grew a lot of cotton in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of folks were timid with growth regulators, rightly so. If you compare the old varieties without growth regulator to the new varieties, which I aggressively manage by the Learning Center standards, what we documented in that was a significant increase in first and second, the likelihood of having a harvestable bowl on a first position and a second position, and it was a numerical increase on third positions. So it was as much as 20%. Like first positions went from 30% in those old varieties with no growth regulator to 50, more than 50% likelihood of harvesting them in a bowl on a first position in the new aggressively managed. The seconds went up, if I remember correctly, somewhere over 13%, and then the thirds were up about 6%. So you got a higher likelihood of having a bowl on basically every position on the plant.
Right.
That's the observation from that. Then you move to the next implication of that. That would be that, or the next finding from that, turnout has increased significantly due to mainly breeding efforts over that 25-year span represented by those genetics. So it went up about, if I remember right, it's about 6% that turnout went up across this test, you know, across comparing those different groups of varieties. So not only do you have more bowls, those bowls weigh more.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at it, and this was a little bit of a confounded matter when we started to look at it. The loan values didn't change that much, but that's not exactly all the story, because some of the newer varieties have fiber properties that run off of the loan chart, basically. You know, you don't, you may get a premium for it in the market, but you don't get it in the value.
Right.
But the real point of our data this year is we didn't go backwards in the process. You just need to take another step to fully measure it. One of the other differences that we did note was there was a reduction in the percentage of the seed delivered as oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's, you know, that's not always viewed as positive, but it just means we have to be, you know, aware of that as we process products and move them in the marketplace. That does have an agronomic implication. All of these things add together to make several agronomic implications that we need to consider when we close out our conversation anyway.
Okay. Is this a study you're going to do again? Is this, or are you done with this one?
No, I am not done with this one. This is too this is too juicy to not carry on. Because what we ultimately showed was the yield potentials improved comparing those two cohorts of varieties.
Yeah.
The yield potential in the old varieties without growth regulator was about 1120. Well, 1190, I think, actually. It was over 1,100 pounds. The yield potential of the new varieties with aggressive growth regulator was about 1900 plus.
Mm-hmm.
So we've improved yield potential. And those are where these agronomic implications come into play.
Yeah.
So, yes, it will be done again, probably in a replicated form, and we'll probably wind up in a journal somewhere before it's over.
Okay. Again, add any more varieties, any increased number this year? Or
no, I increased the remnant of what I had last year, so we'll probably stick with a subset of what we had this year.
Okay.
We're going to blow the scale up, and it'll be a little more replicated, sort of harder science, I guess you would say.
Still using the same plot, or are you going to move it someplace else?
I'll have a demo up here by the office, but it's going to move into a field where I can have replication and randomization and those sorts of things. But yes, it will continue for sure.
Yeah. Now you mentioned, you know, the plant mapping and things like that. There's I guess the historical standard for that was something that was developed many decades ago by, what was it, Jack McCarty?
Yes, sir. It was Drs. McCarty and Jenkins or Jenkins and McCarty at State. I don't know who was senior author.
And now you've moved in and updated basically with
information. That I don't know that was the original intent, but I think that's been the outcome. and that's something that the cotton world has wondered about. You know, think about that publication from 95. As best I can tell, that's the origin of the term money bowls.
Mm-hmm.
And the question has been for that period of time, 25 or 30 years, did the money bowls move?
Yeah.
You know, that map of the cotton plant with the dollars on the bowls and all that, I've sort of redone, well, I got Jay's version of that, I guess, on the cover of this publication when we get it. And the answer to that is sort of. The concentration, I suppose the proportion of the bowls are in similar places. But you've got a higher probability of having those bowls in most of the positions on the plant, if not all.
Yeah, you're spreading the money out basically on the plant.
Yeah, and you're increasing the magnitude even where they were in the older data.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's meant to be that sort of a, I guess, refresh. I'm not in the league of those guys. They're some of my heroes. I think that's great work. It was foundational to my generation of scientists, but I'm tickled that we can go back and try to add to the body of data.
Have they been curious about this study?
They'll know about it, I guess, shortly, but I have held it rather tightly until I got a final version, but I'm going to email it to several people when we get done with this conversation.
Okay.
It's kind of hot off the press.
Yep. No doubt. Okay. So I guess my next question is, with this study getting ready to come off the press, if any of our listeners have any questions about this study, how can they get a copy of this? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can very easily. I'm available. I can't hide here at the Learning Center. I talk to everybody. And you can easily email me here at the Learning Center. It's j.mahaffey@bayer.com. I'm happy to share it. It's yours. You know, I did this not necessarily for any specific purpose other than to contribute to the science and to the cotton business. And it tickles me that Delta Pine will support this sort of effort and work because it has some real agronomic implications. And if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about that.
Go ahead.
As we get through. Mm-hmm. When we talked about the fact that we've got a cotton plant that generates and can set more fruit, and that fruit weighs more, and you've got all these things to consider about oil in the seed and that. If you think about what that means, somehow through the breeding process and the development of these varieties and the inclusion of the biotech traits, we have developed a cotton plant that's a better energy factory. That, I think, is really the foundational statement of this work, is you've got a better energy factory because a cotton plant's basically a thermostat that measures sugar availability all the time. Well, if you got more sugar, more carbohydrates available, you set more fruit. We measured that. If you have that energy going into the right places, in other words, not into excess vegetative growth, you have more energy available to set fruit, which weighs more. And there are some other energy things going on there with the seed. When you think about the dynamic of seed and oil in the seed, takes about twice as much energy to make oil as it does take to make cellulose.
Right.
Well, that makes somewhat more energy available to set and fill fruit. So it's really this cool story of of scientific progress is the way I put it. The breeders make contributions, the biotech and entomology people make contributions, and we've got this package all of a sudden that can, if we manage it correctly, increase our yields and our gross potential profit, our gross potential incomes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the last agronomic implication I would point out is consider all that as a group and think about what happens if you don't have that fruit on the plant for some reason you don't control, like weather or insects that were missed or something like that. If you have a plant that has fertilizer and water and good growth potential, and you have fruit removed and it's a better energy factory, what's it going to happen if it doesn't have a place to put that? It's going to grow,
mm-hmm.
often excessively. And that's why the importance of these PGRs has come to such a forefront in the cotton business. They do better. You know, the cotton varieties perform better. They make higher yields. They do all these other things. But where we have to go out and monitor the plants and respond to what they do in the environment is more critical today than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And that's why we're trying to go out and do this type of work. We do other PGR studies, you know, all of that kind of stuff kind of flows into a system helping, hopefully, so that we can respond when Mother Nature kicks us every once in a while.
And she will definitely kick.
And she will kick. Promise. That's why people like me have the opportunity to go out and work on this stuff. We got to figure out what to do.
Well, it sounds good. Jay, look, I appreciate you taking time to join me today. This has been fascinating. Like I said, I'd love to come back down and take a look at the work once you get the plots in again this year and visit with you a little bit more about it. But again, thanks and good luck with the publication. I do want to get a copy.
Well, you'll have it as soon as we get done. And I would like to say thank you for the opportunity to share this. And anyone that wants to see it, keep in mind, what we talked about on here today in 30 minutes is about 5% of the whole story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no way we could tell the whole thing. But
I'm working on a way to figure that out. And it's probably going to be a series that I launch on social media somehow and do it one piece at a time. But
yeah,
like we said earlier, if you want a copy and you want to talk more detail about it, it's j.mahaffey@bayer.com. You're welcome to call. You're welcome to come visit. And it was my pleasure to be here today.
Great. Thank you, Jace. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of the Cotton Companion Podcast. Thanks again to Jay Mahaffey for joining in on today's discussion. Thanks also to the American Cotton Shippers Association for their continued participation and sponsorship with the Cotton Companion. And as always, thanks to you, dear listeners, for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you like what you heard, please be sure to spread the word, tell your friends about the Cotton Companion podcast. Here's where and how they can find us.
You can find the Cotton Companion in three easy ways. First, go to cottongrower.com/companion or simply click the podcast tab at the top of the homepage. Second, subscribe to our channel on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts these days. And three, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, the Cotton Grower e-news, that's delivered to your email inbox every Tuesday morning. You can do that by going to cottongrower.com/subscribe. Also, be sure to follow Cotton Grower on social media. We are at Cotton Grower Mag on Twitter. And on Facebook, you'll find us by searching for Cotton Grower Magazine.
Cotton Companion Podcast is produced twice monthly by Tyler Hatch and Kim Henderson, our talented colleagues at the world headquarters for Meister Media Worldwide in lovely Willoughby, Ohio. I'm Jim Stedman. And Beck Barnes and I will be back with you in a few weeks with the next episode of The Cotton Companion. Until then, get those planters prepped and stay safe.
Yeah, he works and he works and he works and he works all day. God made the farmer. Yeah, he works and he works and he works and he works and he works all day. God made the farmer. God bless.